VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on The Times radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, this is The Ruck, and we are entering week 7 of lockdown. We hope you're all okay out there. We love you listeners for coming back week after week. Life is now conducted on Zoom, and The Ruck is no different. I'm Owen Slott, and with us this week we have Lawrence, Steve, and the return of the chairman that World Rugby should have had, Mark Evans.
So,
Bill Beaumont was voted back in as chairman of World Rugby 2 days ago. Jonesy, you reported that and gave our readers the result at least a week early, I think.
2 weeks.
2 weeks early you gave it.
Yeah.
Well done. Well done. Ahead of the news as ever. Lawrence, you're very heavily involved in the game in various different departments, but not so much rugby politics. You don't fancy that job yourself?
I'm not sure. I think it's a question of more suitability and eligibility, really. But no, I tend not to agree with everyone on most things, so that doesn't really work out for World Rugby, it would seem.
You're not the consensus man that Bill says he's going to be.
No.
Mark Evans, who's been on this podcast numerous times before, sports administrator. We're not going to go through the list again, but geez, Mark, you've done enough. Mark, we tried to push you on this show last year to get you installed as chief executive of the RFU, but you're not going to come in at World Rugby instead now, then? Well, it's obviously too late, but 4 years' time, it might need rescuing?
Whatever skill set I have, I'm not sure it's particularly well suited to that role.
Oh, Jesus, this is modesty on a level we've never seen from you before.
it's a difference between personal view and opinion. I think those are two different.
Mark, on a serious note, what do you make of the result of the vote and what it means? That's probably an essay question, but go on, give it a crack.
Unexpected. I think the two votes that you raise an eyebrow and maybe Fiji and Samoa voting for Bill Beaumont and away from the sort of the countries they have so much to do with in New Zealand, Australia, etc. I'm not sure it'll make a huge amount of difference in terms of policy. I think it might make more difference in terms of the tone. I think expectations have probably been raised a bit. I think the nation's Cup will be back on the agenda. I think eligibility changes are pretty high up the agenda. And we loved what they were offering, you know. It's a question of execution. Can you actually execute it? There's fewer blocks than there were last time around because of the coronavirus and the parlous financial state of some or most of unions and clubs. But this is all about delivery. And we shouldn't forget World Rugby can only work with the cooperation of its stakeholders. It's not got a huge amount of executive power. You look at where they really do have control and how they maybe ought to be judges. Look at Tier 2. Look at the work they've done in places like Fiji and Samoa and Georgia and others. I mean, that's where people like Mark Egan and others really can wield some influence because the blockages are so much less.
Jonesy, you came in on Sunday with a very positive piece about the way things are going, and you believe that the World Rugby executive can move everything. They appear to have some very bright plans that could move it in the right direction.
No, I didn't see any of that. There's no could about it. They have done so. They have set down a new structure for the whole of the game from Andorra up to New Zealand. It's all in place. It has been accepted by Exco. It has been accepted by the Rugby Committee. All it has to be now is the budget has to be approved, which I understand is a rubber stamping. I'm going to just check with the Sunday Times printers because they appear to have printed the paper on Sunday in invisible ink. Mark Egan is not the man who's going to do it. He has done it. He has done it with executive power. He's done it with everybody in the room. And he has done what the game wanted for 30 years. He has set up promotion and relegation all the way. He set up a division, a global division, which all the teams can play in to assert themselves. And it is a red letter day. And I don't give a monkey's who the chairman is.
But this hasn't been approved by the unions themselves yet. So surely there's a massive hurdle to scale or a wall to run into, as there was last year.
First of all, the Nations Cup is back on the agenda. So who in the Southern Hemisphere is not going to approve that? Who is not going to vote for that? Who is not in the Six Nations is not going to vote for it? And who in the regions is not going to vote for it because it's given them the lifeblood of proper competition? Fiji, Samoa, Tonga, etc., providing they get the medical things right, will suddenly have six home games every year as opposed to the current one. There is no one who's against it.
I love your positivity, and I hope that it can
I'm not being
be
positive. It's not an opinion. It's a news story.
No, but if the countries haven't even said yes to it, it's a plan. I mean, I think it's a good plan, but it's not been
the top body have said yes to it.
The Nations Championship and thereby the global season was very much on the agenda a year ago. I think the objections then were for various different reasons from various different unions. Clearly, the Southern Hemisphere are quite in favour of a Nations Championship. There was reservations, particularly amongst some of the home unions in Europe, around the area of promotion and relegation. But I think what coronavirus has done now has sharpened everyone's focus in terms of actually speaking to each other far more collaboratively and collegiately, because, you know, the financial crisis that coronavirus is going to leave behind, not just in the world, but also for rugby particularly, is now meant that those who were objecting to perhaps a global season might think a little bit differently. And the first question, well, rugby, I guess, have got to ask themselves, and Bill, is of the £75 million in the bank that was generated by the Rugby World Cup in Japan, you know, how much of that is going to have to, go into or go out of the bank account and really assist some of the tier one, tier two, tier three nations to literally be surviving so that they can be at the negotiating table. And then I guess the other issue that we probably should just quickly touch on is that bringing the stakeholders with them is his number one challenge, because now everyone is he can't do anything until we actually know when rugby is going to be played. And in France, they've said that there's no live sport until at least September. In the British Isles, we're rather more hopeful because our needs must in terms of getting domestic and international rugby, you know, behind closed doors. But it's going to be fascinating because I don't think any union, including England, are immune to the financial crisis that's now going to start engulfing the game itself.
Mark, what's your opinion on this? Do you think that we will get this together now that coronavirus has forced this through, and that the executive will manage to make it work?
I think the structural changes that Steve alluded to will probably get through.
Get through what?
What will happen then? All right.
They've been voted through by World Rugby. They've been voted in.
So,
well, not by the World Rugby Council, they haven't.
No, the EXCO is above the council.
That's true.
But they've still got to bring their stakeholders with them, which in Europe means club rugby in France and England. And that, as we know, historically, is a much harder thing to do, whether something's voted in or not.
I agree, Lawrence. But the global season is now in place for internationals.
What I was going to make is that you can get the structural changes into the different divisions, et cetera, but you still have to put it into a calendar and then to execute it effectively. And that, I think, is still a little bit of a way away. And that has always been, historically, the rock on which many, many decent rugby plans are founded. We'll see. I'm not unhopeful, because I do think these times will lend themselves to change in a way that others weren't, and I think certain vested interests are now not quite as powerful as perhaps they were, certainly financially. So, but let's hope so, because it's a terrific opportunity.
I think the calendar is actually the area where they possibly, probably have made some strides forward. I think everyone acknowledges that is an area that has to change and has to simplify and has to work for everyone. And I know Beaumont was talking yesterday about possibly shifting the July international window into October or whatever. I don't know if that's going to happen. And he did say it's a plan. It's not something that's been voted through or whatever. But yeah. I think everyone gets that's got to happen. The calendar purification, if you like. But then again, as Lawrence says, it's easy to say, come on, we all need to work this out. But whenever they try to work it out, like in San Francisco 4 years ago, they can't do it because there's so many people.
Until they know when a game of rugby can actually be played, you know, having back-to-back international windows at the end of the year, in theory, it sounds like a good idea. But we may not see much, much flight travel, you know, teams being able to get on planes, et cetera, and this is what I'm saying, the whole crisis could actually be the undoing of some really good work. And the other question, you know, which probably needs to be posed is, which was asked a little while ago, was that, you know, where does the Six Nations sit within all of this? Clearly, it's currently free to air. With the continuing pressure of coronavirus, particularly for some of the home unions, you know, is that move to put it behind a paywall going to start gathering some serious momentum?
The massive coronavirus problem is, you know, it cannot be overestimated. It's absolutely savage. You just got to hope there'll be a time when we do get over it. But for me, first of all, the two international windows stuck together is pure poppycock invented by one man, as far as I can see. The Lions tour in the autumn, 22,000 people have so far booked to go with the Lions. They always go as part of their summer holidays. Hey, lads, let's all go in September, October on Lions tour. Utter rubbish. There are two international windows at the moment which are perfectly good. And the only thing that is stopping the whole thing slotting in now, apart from coronavirus, is revenue sharing. That is what the Southern Hemisphere are bidding for. They want a chunk of the money at Twickenham, Cardiff, etc. And that is why they're miffed that Gus Pichot didn't get in. The big rugby-only sticking point at the moment is revenue sharing.
Yeah, we asked Bill about that, Bill Beaumont about that on the press conference call yesterday. We said, you know, that if you could bring through revenue sharing, that would really get this whole thing moving along. And he basically said, oh, that's not really my bag. That's for the unions to sort out on their own. For an agent of change, that wasn't quite the answer we were looking for.
No.
Maybe something like banging heads together and that they've got to sort it out might have been a better answer. So Jonesy, just on that thing about the moving windows, you said that's the invention of one man. Are you suggesting that that's only Beaumont who's pushing that? Because he was talking about it yesterday.
What, you can have two international windows every year in November?
No, he was saying, what he was saying, I'm not saying it's a good idea, I'm just reporting here. He was saying you would move July to probably October, and then he said in October you'd have your Northern Hemisphere international teams going south, and then in November they'd all come back again. And it wasn't actually him just saying it, because the communications director said, yeah, this is a plan as well. Again, a plan, no. Not a...
I spoke to probably most people in World Rugby in the last week, and no one mentioned that. Why would you have the two windows together? So suddenly the clubs are going to go 10 weeks, 12 weeks without their players with a further 7 or 8 weeks after Christmas? Doesn't work.
Well, we're trying to guess what they're doing. But if you did it that way, you'd start the club season after all that. And then I think you'd have a club season from December to July, say. Oh, Christ, I don't know. We're making up as we go along here. With just the Six Nations break in the middle. Mark, you need to come in here and talk some sense, because we're scrabbling around looking. We need a rugby administrator here.
There was a reasonable amount of chatter about this 2 months of international windows at the end of the Southern Hemisphere season, October, November, because it would allow the coordination of the Nations Cup to be much easier, and it would give her a greater clarity. And I suppose this is, however, the point I was sort of alluding to earlier. That, although it's a very easy thing for the southern nations to do, it's a very, very difficult thing for the northern hemisphere because of the club game. And so I thought, I'm not surprised Bill was fairly cautious about that yesterday, because you've currently got the July window and the November window. But let's not forget the July window causes some problems as well. You know, we always have these problems with British Lions. We always have these problems with not enough rest for the players before the end of the Heineken Cup and the Premiership, and then going on tour when they're knackered. And also the narrative to the customer. Let's forget why we're in business. No, we're in business to actually put a product in front of people who want to watch it and hopefully grow the number who do so. So I think that there is more, there is quite a, not a head of steam, but there is quite a significant bit of support about the two things. You can either coordinate the fixture list, which is you'd stick it in, you'd keep it in July and November, and you'd try and get as much coordination as you can with more promotion and relegation in certain parts of the world, because I note with interest that it's been said that it isn't going to happen in the Six Nations for a while. Or you'd be more ambitious and you genuinely go for a global season with the internationals at the end, largely, with the TRC and the Six Nations at the beginning, and then you run the club, provincial, super rugby, or whatever comes in place of it, in between, and with a close season of 2 to 3 months. So that really is a global season, and Rugby Union and the North becomes a summer game. Do I think that's going to happen? That's a hell of a stretch.
I think I agree with you, Mark, there. But and actually, for once, agree with Jonesy. The key to unlock it is the financial pot. And if certain unions saw a greater share of the cake, if you like, then all of a sudden they might find some space in their calendars. And I include all the stakeholders in that. Then suddenly they might find some space in their calendars to accommodate pretty much most things.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility, there's more to iPhone.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal, to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
So Bill Bowman wasn't the only winner at the weekend. Maro Itoje was rugby's other notable champion, being declared by the Times and Sunday Times as the current best player in the world. This is what we're going to talk about now. To explain, there were 14 Times and Sunday Times writers who contributed to this poll. We each have named our top 10 players in the world, and we put them all together in some stats bot and worked out the numbers. And we were then able to announce that we had revealed definitively the best 10 players on the planet. We ran this through the paper last week, and I'll read you out the top 10 as voted for by the Times. We had at 10 Tom Curry, at 9 Kyle Sinclair, at 8 we had Ardie Sarvaier, 7 Brodie Retallick, 6 Cheslin Colby, 5 Peter Steffi-Toit, Sammy Radradra was at 4. Followed by DuPont, the French scrum half. Bowden Barrett was at 2. And Maro Itoje was officially the best player in the world. So, as you can imagine, we've probably all got quite strong opinions on this. Who did each of us name who didn't make that top 10, who we feel was harshly done by? Jonesy, let's start with you.
Can you start with someone else? I haven't got a clue. I have to find my top 10. That was someone else.
All right. Lawrence.
Well, firstly, I'm glad that there was some sort of consensus around the top 10. Not everyone made it in there, but, one has to understand or maybe explain that obviously all opinions are subjective. And I'm fascinated to hear from our panel here, how you measure a player's impact. Because if you look at Optostats, then you'll get a very different top 10. For me, rugby has always been a results-driven business, as far as I can work out. It's about the W at the end of the day. And I think you're looking at players who maybe, don't do everything in a game. I look at these stats and you look at a player who has 100 tackles and you go, well done, you've done your job. What that tells you is that you've got a really good engine on you, or the opposition are actually running down your channel rather a lot. So for me, selection is about doing things that actually influence the outcome of the game. So when I was looking at my top 10 and I was looking at form, because it was asked to produce a top 10 now, not maybe last year or the year before, which players actually do things that affect the outcome of a game. Now, I added a couple of others that didn't make the list and, for various reasons. It's interesting, 8 out of 10 that did make the list all appeared in the semi-finals of the Rugby World Cup, with the exception of Dupont and Redradra. Vakatawa, I think, can consider himself a little bit unlucky on current form. I think he's one of the outstanding players. Obviously, the New Zealand-born French centre who played most of his rugby on the wing. I think the little Shetland pony, Faf de Klerk, I think can also consider himself somewhat unlucky, as can one or two of the South African front row. But I guess if you get rotated, it's also about longevity and how many times you're actually named in the team. But I think those two can count themselves a little bit unlucky.
Jones, have you found your team yet?
Yes, I have. Owen, first of all, you mentioned this was the selection of 14 rugby writers on Times and Sunday Times. Can you give me their names? Because I'm doing the Sunday Times on my own. Who were the other 13, by the way? Have I ever met them? 14 rugby writers? Bloody hell. All right.
Stuart Barnes.
My big objection, if this is a form side, and as Lawrence said, it should be, is Bowden Barrett, who's absolutely like a caged animal during the World Cup and all the previous season. I don't think he's remotely up there. And I think George Ford, who I've been critical of, is actually at a much better World Cup than Barrett in almost every respect. I actually like the rest of them. I mean, I've always thought that Whitelock is actually a better lock than Vitalik. But I actually like the top 10 we had. Maro Toji, we're still waiting for him to have the equivalent of the second season syndrome. I don't think he's had a dip in his career, so he's well up there. I sense the presence of Barnes in the selection of Bowden Barrett up high. Otherwise, Peter Steph de Toit, no objections there. Cheslin Colby, no objections, and I think it's a very strong team, and I think they are the form team. Just one more thing, though, Owen. I watched again the England semi-final against New Zealand on Sunday. Blimey, Curry had a great game, but Underhill that day was out of this world. He was out of this world. So I think he would be close on form to that top 10.
So who did you have in your top 10 who didn't make it in, Steve? What did you say?
I think I had nine of that ten. So I had most of them. I think I possibly had Underhill in it, but I'm quite happy with all the rest. I really am.
Okay, so I was with Lawrence. I had Vakatawa in my top ten as well. And yeah. I don't know if it's because I normally sit at rugby games next to Alex Lowe, but we both had another Fiji and Pekele Yato in our yes. top ten as well. Which was maybe somewhat from the heart rather than the head, because he didn't really have much of a Rugby World Cup, did he, for very unfortunate reasons. You might think I'm completely bonkers on this, because I didn't have Tom Curry or Sam Underhill in my top 10, but I did have Michael Hooper, who maybe might have played some better rugby 2 years ago, but what I saw of him during the World Cup was one man almost single-handedly trying to carry his nation through, and having never having a bad game, almost never having a bad involvement, and genuinely changing games. So those are the players that I had in who I thought were deserving of mention. What about you, Mark?
I looked at it, good day prep for the podcast, and I agree with eight of them. I think the top eight would be in my top 10. Kyle Sinclair, I can't get away from that World Cup final. And it wasn't him going, that would have clinched it for me. But of course, we all know what happened. I'm not quite sure he's yet done enough to be in my top 10 in the world. I'm a huge Malcolm Marks fan. I just think he's just a phenomenon. And he's done it for quite a while. And I know this is now, but I think he's got to have a bit of longevity to make a world top 10. It's not just the 10 best players at the World Cup. I think you've got to be a little bit broader than that. So I would probably question Carl Sinclair and Tom Curry. Yeah, I had Bakatawa as well. And I think Evan Etzebeth is massively underrated. And as I say, Malcolm Marks. And it's really surprising. He's had a little bit of a dip, but geez, I struggle not to put Owen Farrell in the top 10, which now gives me 11, which is ludicrous.
Okay.
Yeah. I actually did put Owen Farrell in there, but didn't make the cut. And I'd certainly have him in there ahead of 9 and 10 in the list. No disrespect to either of their performances. So I do agree on that. The Bowden Barrett one is the interesting one because, a bit like Mark, you know, clearly Jonesy, I think if people assessed his form right now, it's nowhere near where it has been in the past. But my word, I have to say he has done some spectacular things on the rugby field.
Yeah.
Beaten more defenders than any other player in world rugby. Yes, he does play for the best team. He scored 27 tries on his own, which, on the basis New Zealand score 5 a game, that's not that hard. He also assists, and I think he was just undone by the fact that he was played out of position in the World Cup and maybe mixed around a little bit. But he does things on a field that excite, rugby fans. And, for that reason, I do think he deserves to be there.
You say he was out of position during the World Cup. We love making these lists, don't we? But when we were doing our World Cup top 15 at the end of Japan, I had... Barrett is my fullback. He wasn't playing in his best position, but I still thought his impact was strong enough there to go in there. Actually, I don't think there was. I remember scratching my head on that one because there weren't so many outstanding alternatives. But
unusual to see no. And I'm not saying this because I played there, but no number eights on this list. Which according to Eddie Jones, there is one number eight on the list, but For me, it should be a position, and it hasn't changed, over many, many years that influences games. But yet we don't see any of the world's number eights making that cut,
Lawrence, who would yours be? Because when I was doing my list, my 10th position, I had Dwayne Vermeulen in and out of it all the time.
No, I don't think any of the number eights currently playing deserve necessarily to be there. I'm not arguing with the list. I'm just quite surprised. Yeah. I'm quite surprised that they haven't been able to do that. They're not quite hit their top form.
When this all started appearing in the paper last week, you won't be remotely surprised to hear that there was a lot of angry comeback on the comments section from our Celtic readers, particularly Welshmen, who couldn't understand why there wasn't a single Welsh player on that list. Now, again, when I was doing my list, trying to work out who my 10th man was, I was playing around with Tipperick and Liam Williams as well, who kind of would be in my top 15. Do you think we've been hard on them or?
No, Wales were a different sort of side. Wales are very much a kind of team without brilliant individuals, especially when Faletau could make it, that were very highly competent rugby players, beautifully organised. And actually, if you look at the Wales South Africa game again, there was a time clearly in that game where this looked like winning that as well. So, no, I don't think there was a Welshman in the top 10 at the moment. Faletau at his very best would have been in mind, but he's not been at his very best. It's as simple as that.
But it's also a window as well, isn't it? As Mark was saying, maybe 18 months ago, James Ryan might have made that list because everything he touched turned to gold. Tadhg Furlong was certainly there. Conor Murray for a period of time. Aaron Smith at 9. But I do think that those to our Welsh friends, those moments have passed now, and we're talking about maybe the last 12 to 24 months, which I think belongs to that list. And that list is the very top table of world rugby. And to get on that list, you've got to be exceptionally good. And if you can honestly, hand on heart, tell me that there's a Welshman, Irishman right here, right now, or a Scotsman that deserves to get in ahead of any one of those players, you know, I'd question that.
Did anyone disagree with Marrow as the number one on that list? Marrow Itoje? Mark's wincing. You clearly did.
Well, not. I think, I guess, when you get down to the best player in the world, I just don't buy it as a concept, really.
Well, that's fair enough. That's fair enough. But don't come on this podcast then if you don't want to talk about it.
The positional requirements are so different. He is an absolutely extraordinary athlete and rugby player. And does it? I think the key point Steve made is that the guy has hardly had a dip. He did, actually, once. I think in the 2019 Six Nations, I remember being on this podcast. Did anyone see Mario Itoje in the last 2 or 3
seasons? I think, Mark, the reason why I think he does make number one is it's not just the quality of his performances, but it's actually, in the last 12 months, it's been the games that he's actually played well in. Because, Make no mistake, there are big games, and then there are ginormously huge games. And Dublin away, when England dismantled Ireland, and he was the outstanding performer. And I think the Lions' performance against New Zealand, and then again, the semi-final performance against New Zealand. And actually, for once, the stats do back him up. You know, he had, I think, double the number of turnovers of any player during the World Cup. And these were in games that really, you know, the knockout games that really mattered. And I think for that reason, I think he probably does creep up to number one. I can tell you now that I stayed at one club for 20 years, but anyone who thinks or is under any illusions that if I didn't feel that I had the opportunity to win trophies, because that's what the game was all about back then, I would have moved in a heartbeat.
Yeah, that's why Jonesy stayed at the Sunday Times all these years, isn't it?
Well, exactly, on my own.
He's doing it all on his own. From the sauna.
Producer, have we got some violin music we could play here? Well, listen, on the subject of Jonesy and having to fight a lone battle on his own, should we move on to one of our favourite old themes, which is Jones's Moans?
Well, Jonesy. I've got a health, political and health one this week. This morning, I was listening to the radio and there were four people who were all New Zealanders on there discussing, telling our health service, our government and our population how to deal with the coronavirus. And they were saying, one of them said, I am so proud to be a Kiwi today because we have not had one person pass away in New Zealand in the last 24 hours. And surely the British government should be looking south for the... and that infuriated me. Nothing could be better than Kiwis not losing anyone to the coronavirus. Long may they lose no one every day to the coronavirus. But to get the message from a country where no one lives outside Auckland, only 9 people live in the South Island, for them to tell us that they're proud of themselves as if we are actually deliberately killing people in this country is something completely beyond the pale, even for Kiwis.
To see that has been incredible. It took action very, very early. They got 5 million people, and the size of your country doesn't necessarily mean that you still don't have to do the right thing. I love the way...
Of course it does. What about the density of population? They've got separation without even being separated.
I love the waste of paper. I haven't seen any other premier in the world doing that. I thought that was a great bit of leadership. And they went real, real early. They shut the whole thing down after one case. I understand that each country has to do what they think works for their country and autonomy for the nation state. Completely agree. But I don't think you can criticise too heavily that what New Zealand have done has been incredibly effective.
Steve, give us your other moan.
Mark Evans is the other one.
Well, honoured. I'm honoured.
Some smart ass coming on our podcast. We should all be moaning about that.
Listen, the other thing is, I just got one more. I can think of 3 of our rugby writers. Who are the other 11? Because they've done nothing for 20 years. Have they been in lockdown or something? Like 14 rugby writers? Right.
Thanks for that, Jonesy. So we're going to see if we can find another 11 rugby writers for you for next week. The Sunday Times this coming weekend should be very interesting. Mark Evans, great to have you back. I'm sure we'll have you back in soon. Lawrence, good to see you as ever. I hope you get let out of your locked-in office there for lunch or dinner, maybe. This was The Ruck. We will, as ever, be back next week. Thank you for joining us. Stay safe out there. Stay well.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Do you ever feel like your brain is on overdrive and your mind is constantly racing? The plans, worries, and to-do lists are never ending. Calm can help your mind take a break from the noise by softening anxiety symptoms in the moment and helping you cope with day-to-day stressors. Calm is the number one app for sleep and meditation, giving you the power to calm your mind and change your life. For listeners of the show, Calm is offering an exclusive offer of 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/stressless. Go to calm.com/stressless for 40% off unlimited access to Calm's entire library. That's calm.com/stressless.